Your radio, CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
We're going to talk today to Zafar Bengash about all these recent developments, the massive unreported demonstration that took place in Baghdad this past Friday. The Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, CBC chose not to report it. Millions of people, actually, and just to show how important it is to fight false news, CP24, cable, whatever it is, I was watching, they did mention it. They said hundreds demonstrated. That's why we have to talk to Zafar. Zafar Bengash knows the region, has contact with almost all the names that are in the news, and has a good knowledge of them. We're going to go into the subject of what's going on with that demonstration and the reaction from Washington. And latter part of the show, we're going to speak to Tony Leah of Green Jobs Oshawa. And I want everybody to know right now that Nikki Ashton is going to be in Toronto, Nikki Ashton MP, and that's Thursday, January the 30th at 7 o'clock at the Rhino Bar. Thursday, 7 o'clock at the Rhino Bar. And Linda McQuaig will also be speaking, Paul Taylor, and others. Rebecca Keach of Green Jobs Oshawa is going to be talking. So that's an important event. We want you to know about it. It's Thursday, January 30, 7 p.m., Rhino Bar, 1249 Queen Street West, the Skylight Room. Nikki Ashton, Linda McQuaig are heading up the speakers. We're joined now by, I believe, Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I'm with you.
Thank you very much. We need to hear from you today because we really have a problem. The media here have chosen not to tell us about kind of important matters. I am alluding to the fact that this past weekend, Friday, I believe it was, in Baghdad, they had probably the most massive demonstration. I'll ask your factual your opinion about that in modern Iraqi history, and the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, the CBC. I'm not aware of their even reporting it. I did see on a local channel they said that hundreds had demonstrated on behalf of a one Iraqi leader who they identified as Shia, and they said he was supported by pro-Iran militia. In other words, I mean, frankly, a lie. I mean, this is a case of, that's not even a half-truth. Can you tell us how big the demonstration, because everybody talks about it, in your opinion, but and also what was the message and who did call that demonstration?
Yes, the demonstration last Friday the initial call was given by Muqtada al-Sadr, who is a very powerful religious as well as political figure in Iraq. He has the largest group of MPs in the Iraqi parliament. Mm-hmm. But his call was immediately endorsed by all the political groups in Iraq. And the number of people that turned out, he had called for a million-man march. And all of the video footage that I have seen, it indicated that it was definitely more than a million people. And as you mentioned, unfortunately, our media outlets over here, some of them talked about a few hundred, others talked about a few thousand. Mm-hmm. The BBC said it was a huge crowd, but didn't give a figure. CNN said it was several thousand. And the CBC said that it did not meet the target of a million people. Now, I'm not quite sure exactly how any of these outlets were able to figure that out, because Press TV of Iran was giving live coverage, and the masses stretched for miles and miles and miles. I mean, they had a helicopter overhead filming this thing, and you could just, these masses just stretched endlessly. And in fact, some of the alternate media have given other figures. Mint Press, for instance, gave a figure of 2.5 million, whereas Global Reach or Global Outreach, the Montreal-based website, they even quoted a figure of 4 million. Mm-hmm. But definitely, by all accounts, there were definitely more than a million people. And they did not come out on the call of only one person. As I mentioned, many political leaders issued the call, and they were unanimous in their call. The slogans that they were shouting, they said, respect Iraq's sovereignty, occupiers get out of Iraq. These were the slogans that were being raised, and it was clear that it was directed primarily against the presence of U.S. forces over there, 5,000 of them altogether, although the number has been reduced somewhat since the January 3rd assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, as well as the deputy commander of the Iraqi militia units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, that America and Canada as well, and some other countries that had forces over there, they relocated them to Kuwait. According to my information, the Canadian forces have not gone back to Iraq. And our defense minister, Harjit Singh, has said that if the Iraqi government asks us to leave, then we would do so. We would comply with their wishes. And, of course, this has to be a formal request. Now, Canada has 500 forces or allocated 500 forces to Iraq.
Yeah. By the way, there's an asterisk that goes beside that, Canadian forces, because they've done this rather cute, in my opinion, political maneuver of having a Canadian general be in charge of NATO forces.
Yes, exactly.
And so that, you know, it's like he takes one card out of his the deck, and then but he adds another.
Yes, there is a lady general that is supposed to be in charge of the NATO forces over there. And it is rather revealing that although they, when the Iraqi parliament passed, voted on a motion on January the 5th, demanding that U.S. pull its forces out of Iraq, the Americans said, well, that motion in parliament is not binding on the Iraqi government unless the Iraqi government asks us to do so. So the Iraqi prime minister, Adel Abdul Mehdi, formally asked the U.S. government to get its forces out of Iraq. And he also said that we want you to send your representatives so that we can sit down and work out the withdrawal schedule. And the Americans again said, well, that is a request from the Iraqis, and so we are not going to pull our forces out. Donald Trump has said that.
Yes.
Mike Pompeo has said that.
We should remind everybody what kind of world we're living in, and how Canada, its odd little role of continually saying, well, you know, we respect the will of people, that we're interested in the rule of law. And you have a president of the United States who's told that we want you to take your forces out. And he says, if I do that, I'm going to punish you.
Yes.
And with sanctions, he said that will be worse than the ones I'm presently putting in place against the Islamic Republic. And Canada stands by mute and looks out the window. And this is ridiculous. This is a madman in terms of his arrogance. That is totally illegal, and it's the kind of thing, if they were to debate it, you know, openly at the General Assembly, the Americans would be voted, you know, like 500-1 against.
Yes. Actually, there is a you know, a larger story behind that. In November of last year, that is 2019, the Iraqi Prime Minister went to China and signed an agreement with the Chinese to complete certain infrastructure projects, as well as build roads and bridges and gas plants, etc., because the U.S. had refused to do so. And then when the Iraqi Prime Minister came back to Baghdad, he revealed that information in Parliament. He said that when I came back from China, this is in January, of course, on January the 5th, when that resolution was passed in Parliament. He said that when I returned from China, I got a call from Trump telling me to not fulfill the agreement that I have signed with China. Otherwise, there are going to be problems for you. Mm-hmm. And the Iraqi Prime Minister said that I told Trump that I am not going to repudiate that agreement. We are going to go ahead with it. Mm-hmm. And then he said that Trump called me a week later or so, and he said that unless and until you repudiate that agreement with China, I'm going to have snipers on buildings, and we're going to start shooting people from those buildings. And following that threat,
this is an elected official of Iraq reporting what he was told.
Yes, absolutely. And then a week or so later, the Iraqi defense minister issued a statement. He said, he didn't name the U.S., but he said, third parties are killing, shooting at people, demonstrators in the streets, and they are killing them. This is the Iraqi defense minister. So now the Iraqi prime minister then said that he got another call from Trump, and he said that unless and until, no, he didn't say unless and until, he said, I'm going to have our snipers kill you and your defense minister as well. This is the Iraqi prime minister speaking in parliament on record, stating this.
Yes, and by the way, a prime minister who was not known as an anti-American guy. He was thought to be politically, well, kind of hard to identify, but friendly to the U.S.
Exactly. In fact, you know, the Iranian general who was assassinated had, in fact, come to Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi prime minister, and General Soleimani was carrying a message from the Iranian leadership in response to a message that the Saudis had sent through Iraq to Iran. Mm-hmm. This was basically the Saudi message that they wanted to reduce tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and also see if they could find a way to end the war, the Saudi war on Yemen. Now, the Iraqi prime minister notified the U.S., and told the U.S. that I am inviting this Iranian general. He's coming on a peace mission. He's on a diplomatic mission. And the Americans said, yes, it's okay. We have no objection to that. And so, basically, what the Americans did was that, on the one hand, they told the Iraqi prime minister that it's okay. You have our blessings as well. Mm-hmm. And yet, when the Iranian general arrived in Baghdad, the Americans assassinated him.
Yes.
So the point that you had raised, that the Iraqi prime minister was not necessarily hostile to the U.S., he was working with the U.S., he had entered into a number of agreements with the U.S., but he was now facing threats of destabilization, as well as step or threats that the Americans are going to kill him. So this is the situation, mm-hmm. which is on record. The Iraqi prime minister has put this on record.
Yeah. And so, and with this demonstration, it's on record not only the leader and the parliament, but the people, and yet we have a kind of a static situation where they say, well, if we're properly asked. Apparently, there is no proper way to ask them. I get that impression. By the way, we're speaking to Zafar Bengash, and I want you to know it, if you can find Zafar at crescent.icit-digital.org. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
I work very hard to get these things right.
Thank you.
This is Zafar Bengash. And now, there's so much going on. And Zafar, for background, I wonder about this thesis. The United States, actually, and its allies, UK, France, have been trying to control, manipulate this post-colonial world. And they have a habit of, or a belief that they will succeed. But isn't, and when they got into a problem, they didn't defeat Syria. Syria has survived an Obama-led assault on them. They have not defeated the people of Yemen. They are, today, we're getting dramatic news, suffered another blow at the hands of the Afghanistan population. And they are not doing well in Iraq. So isn't it the case that they're trying to pretend that this all has to do with Iran when it actually has to do with their aggressive and brutal policies?
Yes, of course.
And I should say failing policies.
Yes. Unfortunately, that is what they do. They divert attention from their own misdemeanors and try to blame others and make scandalous allegations, particularly against Iran. As you pointed out, in Afghanistan, when the U.S. and its so-called coalition of the willing had invaded Afghanistan back in October of 2001, it was ostensibly to defeat Al-Qaeda, but then the U.S. went about bombing Afghanistan, already a very, very poor country, virtually living in the Stone Age, the majority, of course, of the population, barring...
They always pick the poorest, same with Yemen.
Yes, apart from a few Afghan cities like Kabul and Herat and one or two other places, the rest of the country, the people live in rural areas in very, very poor, primitive conditions, mud huts and only one well, perhaps a few miles away from the village where people go to get their water. So in very, very poor conditions, and yet the U.S. has gone there and dropped hundreds of thousands of bombs on that country. It has spent $1.5 trillion over the last 18, 19 years. And in fact, in November or December, actually, there was a report that came out which indicated that American generals themselves were saying throughout that yes. This war is unwinnable. We don't know what the mission is. We are just throwing resources. We have spawned a culture of corruption. And those reports actually were coming out since 2005. It's not something that occurred yesterday. And yet they were deliberately hidden from the public eye. And the generals, the Pentagon, and White House officials always talked about the great successes that they are achieving, how they are building schools there and hospitals and training the Afghan army, whereas in fact they spawned a culture of corruption whereby even today the Americans cannot say that the Afghan forces, the 300,000 or so forces that they have quote-unquote trained, will be able to hold their own against the people's resistance. Mm-hmm. And the same people, the Taliban, that they accused of being terrorists and had some of their leaders even thrown in Guantanamo Bay, they have now been released. And three of those people that were in Guantanamo Bay are now part of the negotiation team of the Taliban, negotiating with the Americans to work out a timetable for U.S. troops withdrawal. And the latest reports that I have seen indicate that they have in principle agreed upon a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. forces. In the last month or so, there have been reports that of the 14,000 forces, the Americans have already pulled out 2,000. And for the others also, another perhaps 4,000 are going to be pulled out, in return for which the Taliban have agreed to a temporary ceasefire of about 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
So all the reports indicate that they, as soon as the agreement is signed, then the Taliban would observe a ceasefire. And mm-hmm. if the agreement is not signed, as unfortunately Trump tore up that agreement or walked away from that agreement last September, when in fact the agreement was completed, and that resulted in much greater resistance activity by the Taliban, so that this time around, one hopes that the Americans would not just walk away from that. Otherwise, that war will continue. There'll be more American casualties. Mm-hmm. As you asked and mentioned, that there was an American CIA plane that was shot down today.
Yes.
The Americans said it collapsed due to technical fault or whatever, but they...
technical problem flying over Taliban territory.
Yeah, and the Taliban said that they shot it down because it was a CIA plane, and the Taliban also said that there were a number of American military officers, obviously CIA officers as well. The Americans tried to, and the Afghan government also tried to obfuscate the reality by saying that a civilian airliner of the Afghan airline had crashed. And mm-hmm. the Afghan airline immediately issued a statement, and they said that none of our planes have crashed anywhere. So their own airliner officials are contradicting the
yes.
statements issued by the Afghan government and by the Americans. And
yeah.
all of the markings on that plane, the photographs have come out. RT has published
photographs. Yeah, it's all over the internet.
Exactly. It's all over the internet. The markings are clearly those of... it's, of course, a Bombardier Grumman plane, something E-111 mm-hmm. or something, but it is clearly marked as, the markings are clearly that of a military plane.
No, that's a dramatic development. So this point just underlines that the U.S. is, I don't know if you could say they're overextended, but they're losing on a lot of fronts. In Syria, there's a steady advance by the Syrian army into that area called Idlib, in which I get the impression that the ISIS or Al-Qaeda, whoever they are, and certainly they are terrorists, are taking their people out. And we've even heard stories of Turkey taking some of them and sending them to Libya.
Yes. Yes, actually, what
this is a meltdown for NATO. NATO, I mean, Turkey's a NATO country. I don't know if anybody knows that, but they are. And here you have this, you know, a meltdown. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes, you're right. In Syria, the Syrian army is making steady progress against these ISIS terrorists, who are bottled up in a small area inside Idlib province. And as you pointed out, Turkey has taken some of these people and flown them to Libya. It's ironic that, you know, many of these people had actually come from Libya.
Yes, now they're just going home.
They're going home now.
Yes.
And some, of course, have ended up in Afghanistan. The mm-hmm. former Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, had said in an interview with CBS News as far back as October of 2018, he had said that unmarked helicopters are bringing ISIS terrorists into Afghanistan. And the only party capable of doing that is the United States, because the U.S. controls the Afghan airspace. So obviously nobody else can be bringing these people in but the United States. So that is something that the former Afghan president had said on record to CBS News in an interview in October of 2018. Mm-hmm. The other factor is that now that the Iraqis have demanded that the U.S. pull its forces out of Iraq, that previously the Americans would transport these people back and forth between Syria and Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And that avenue also appears to be coming to an end, because the Iraqis simply will not allow these terrorists to be going back and forth.
Yes, we spoke of that earlier, where there is a kind of hot point here which is causing the U.S. to really strike out, trying to use air power to keep their terrorist friends working. But if Iraq and Syria can secure their mutual border, that the terrorists will be wiped out.
Yes, and I think they will be, because they have been defeated in Syria, as we've been discussing, that the Syrian army has regained control of all of its territory except a few portions in Idlib province, and there also these terrorist groups are losing ground, and also they are being moved out of there and being sent to places like Libya and Afghanistan, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, that means that the Syrian project is virtually coming to an end. And mm-hmm. if the American forces are removed from Iraq, as the Iraqis are demanding, of course, the Americans have relocated them to Kuwait, but then the 2,000 or so American troops in Syria would also not be able to stay in Syria. They would also have to leave.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that both in Iraq as well as in Syria, American/NATO would have been defeated. And mm-hmm. also in Yemen, which is a very, very poor country, but the Yemenis are showing great determination, and they have been able to inflict.
They captured a strategic area in the east just quite recently, right?
Yes, yes.
And absolutely. That's a breakthrough.
Exactly. And in fact, even in the south, around the port city of Aden, which is far away from where the Houthi tribesmen and Ansarullah fighters are, yet they have been able to make gains against the Saudi Emirati forces in Aden.
Mm-hmm.
And so despite the fact that Yemen is under total siege, the Houthis and the Ansarullah fighters cannot get any outside support. That means they can't get any weapons from the outside or food, yet they are able to continue such valiant resistance and are able to not only hold on to the territory that they have, including the capital city, Sana'a, but they're also able to make forays far south into the country, all around Aden. So that shows their courage and determination and their ability to be able to hold on to their gains, as well as to inflict casualties on the Saudis.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, the Ansarullah fighters have inflicted massive casualties on the Saudis in the north of Yemen, which borders Saudi Arabia, these provinces of Najran, Asir, and so on, which, of course, these areas belong to Yemen, but they were illegally occupied by the Saudis back in 1934. And so the Yemenis are saying that we are going to retake this territory, and unless and until the Saudis get out of our country and get their mercenaries out, we are going to keep going until we have driven the Saudis out of Makkah, Medina, and Riyadh as well. And I think they will do it.
Yes.
They're determined people.
Yes. It may explain why the Saudis had started telling the Iraqi prime minister, we'd like to talk to the Islamic Republic.
Exactly.
They probably noticed that the U.S. has a reputation for deserting its friends,
yes.
Particularly if the fighting gets, if the going gets rough. We're speaking to Zafar Vengesh. By the way, the site is crescent.icit-digital.org. And in the final minutes we have, Zafar, I want to ask you also about the situation in Lebanon, because the media here is all excited. They're terrified that there's a new cabinet is being formed, and Western media is calling it a Hezbollah cabinet. And of course, the Canadian Parliament considers Hezbollah terrorist, despite the fact it's a significant part of the elected government of Lebanon. But a detail that I saw today, I found amusing. Here they're calling it a Hezbollah cabinet, and 12 members of the cabinet are American citizens.
So America has Hezbollah.
And six of them, seven are women.
Yes.
So, and everybody's trying to understand that. Is this a step forward, a step back? How do you view this?
Well, definitely Lebanon needs a government. And incidentally, it is now led by Hassan Diab, who is the person whom the French had arrested, and the Canadians had played a role in it, in keeping the poor guy, you know, in prison, accused of terrorism, etc.
Ah.
And he's completely innocent. Mm-hmm. Absolutely innocent. He had done absolutely nothing. He has, in fact...
Well, he offended the French.
He has, in fact, sued the Canadian government for illegally, you know, having mm-hmm. him incarcerated.
So he's now, do you say the president?
Prime Minister designate, and in fact, he has been, you know, obviously the parliament has to vote.
Relations are probably cool with Canada for a while.
I'm afraid they would be, because if you mistreat people like that, obviously he's, and he's certainly not a member of Hezbollah. He's, you see, they keep on talking about Hezbollah-led government, and said that's not the case. Hezbollah is one of the constituent parties, and Hezbollah has always said that they do not wish to dominate the government. They want to have representation of all political factions because they want to have peace in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, obviously Hezbollah is a member of parliament, but they don't have a majority in parliament. And so the prime minister naturally has to get the support of the majority of parliamentarians.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different factions, and Hezbollah as a group is also a their members are in parliament, and they some of their members would be in the Lebanese cabinet. And Hassan Diab has vowed to end corruption, to provide the services that people have been protesting about. And he has vowed to take care of these things. I mean, we wish him well, because he is an economist, and hopefully he should be able to address some of the concerns of the people.
That's a very important... I'm really glad I asked you. This is Zafar Benghazi who's speaking with. And Zafar, in the last point here, we've had... First of all, Canada has to decide whether it's going to be part of the U.S. war wagon and all this threatening and actual assassination of leaders, et cetera, which could draw us into a war. And particularly, we've had this ugly episode in Iraq. The following that, because there was a war footing, and there remains a war footing between the Islamic Republic and the United States, what has happened between the two of them at any moment could get completely out of hand. And there was the tragedy of the plane that was shot down, really showing the hazards of having confrontations between states. I just wonder, isn't it time that somebody think of something new? For example, reopening the embassy, Canadian embassy, or asking if we can, reopening the Iranian embassy here, and ending sanctions. Wouldn't that be a helpful thing at this stage to avoid further conflict?
Absolutely. In fact, many Iranian Canadians who are here and who may not necessarily be supporters of the Islamic Republic have also called for opening diplomatic relations, because they say that opening embassies and having diplomatic relations does not necessarily mean endorsing any country's policies.
No, that's right. That's what an embassy is. Embassy is just an embassy. It's not
exactly
a political position.
In fact, Canada's last ambassador in Tehran had an article in the Globe and Mail just after this plane tragedy, and he once again said that Canada should have diplomatic presence in Iran, because right now, Canada is actually handicapped by the fact that it has no consular office there, although the people, some of the passengers on that plane were Canadian citizens of Iranian origin. And I also want to point out that out of 176 people on board, including the crew members, 127 were Iranian citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, we keep on hearing that there
yes.
are 57 Canadian citizens.
Yeah, there's been this kind of weaponization of tragedy and trying to argue about nationality, ethnicity, when these people were a majority Iranians.
Iranians, exactly.
Who have family. You know, when they started talking about, oh, where should the... It's really morbid. They started, and the body should come here. How could any state say that? That's a family issue.
Exactly. And also, I can tell you that a number of people have already been buried in Iran whose bodies have been identified through DNA tests, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Iran has said that the countries whose citizens were on that plane, whether it was Afghanistan, Britain, Germany, Canada, whatever, they invited them to come to Iran to participate in the investigation, and Iran extended all help. I mean, I think Iran has gone out of its way, despite the fact that it has no diplomatic relations with Canada, that it provided visas to Canadian officials to go to Tehran and to be part of the investigation, as well as the other process of identifying bodies. And as you pointed out, if the families want to bury their loved ones over there or want to have those bodies shipped to Canada, then that's up to the families to decide rather than for any government to decide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on the matter of travel, my understanding is we've seen the policy actually in the days now, just the past 3 or 4 days, the U.S. government hostility to any Iranian of any political perspective traveling through or in and around airspace that they control is problematic. If Canada had ordinary relations, respectful, mutually respectful relations, and ended sanctions, communications, travel, whatnot would be safer, and options would be more options for Iranians coming and going.
Yes. In fact, you know, the day after that plane tragedy, there were many Iranians who were living in the U.S. that were visiting Canada, and upon return to the United States, they were held for endless hours, interrogated and subjected to all kinds of harassment, mm-hmm. which is very, very unfortunate because, you know, as I pointed out earlier, it's not necessary that many of these people were in any way necessarily sympathetic to the Islamic Republic of Iran, but since they were of Iranian origin, this is the kind of...
It's a racial profile.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yes. We've been speaking to Zafar Benghazi, very beneficial. Zafar, we do appreciate it and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, thank you. Zafar Benghazi and Crescent International. We have a satirical piece. I think it was in a movie. I think you might enjoy it. It's about U.S. guys training to go and protect America's world. And so we're going to play a bit of that, and we'll come back with Tony Leah.
Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Iraq.
Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Iraq.
I don't care if I ever come back.
I don't care if I ever come back.
From poor families, how far we roam.
From poor families, how far we roam.
So the rich kids can just stay at home.
So the rich kids can just stay at home.
When I come home with PTSD.
When I come home with PTSD.
The VA hospital won't care for me.
The VA hospital won't care for me.
I'll probably end up homeless out in the dark.
I'll probably end up homeless out in the dark.
To get played on screen by Pocket Mark.
The guy wanted to get one more word. And if you're watching, by the way, you can probably find this on the net. Do look at it, because the guy leading the platoon, when he says, "I'll be end up in a movie being played by Marky Mark," and then it's quiet, and he looks behind him, and everybody's gone, which is appropriate. You know, one of the great kings, I forget, I'll think of his name in a moment, but anyhow, of Europe, said on one occasion, he said, if the soldiers in my army would stop and reflect, there wouldn't be any soldiers in my army. And I heard that from Sterling Hayden, who read it to a crowd. He says that's all he wanted to say. He just read that out. And this is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT. We're on SoundCloud and Facebook.